You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Few temples are built anymore. We have learned that what is sacred can't be contained, that the spirit can't be contained or sustained inside a mere building. Buildings crumble. It's the spirit that lives on. If you had a temple in the secret spaces of your heart, what would you worship there? What would you bring as a sacrifice? What would be hidden behind the curtain in the Holy of Holies? We light our flame today to symbolize that enduring spirit that lives inside all of us. Well, good morning and welcome to this service of worship. It's called a service because it means to serve you, and it is worship, which comes from the word worth-ship, because we raise to worth things that matter. My name is Rob McPherson, the minister of this church, welcoming you on behalf of generations of Unitarians who have worshipped in similar gatherings in South Australia since 1854. This is a radically inclusive spiritual community predicated on love alone. It doesn't matter what God or gods you believe in, or don't, or aren't sure about. It doesn't matter how you gender identify. My preferred pronouns are he, him, and his. It doesn't matter what political leanings you have, and it doesn't matter who you love or prefer to make love with. Everyone is welcome to worship with us. No matter who you are, this community offers to support you as you find and fashion and follow your own spiritual path. Whatever path helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all people. Please do join us after today's service for coffee, tea, and conversation. Let's join together in singing our opening hymn, O Come Emmanuel, with some well-scrubbed Unitarian lyrics. Rise as you are able.
Think about a particularly meaningful experience in your life. Chances are it involved a feeling of awe or connection, holding a baby in your arms, being immersed in nature, experiences where you were outside yourself. When we are at one with what is occurring, at that moment we transcend the boundaries of the self, the individual ego, and become something larger.
It's from something written a long time ago. I salute you. I am your friend, and my love for you goes deep. There is nothing I can give you which you have not, but there is much very much, that while I cannot give it, you can take. No heaven can come to us unless our hearts find rest in it today. Take heaven. No peace lies in the future, which is not hidden in this present little instant. Take peace. The gloom of the world is but a shadow. Behind it, yet within our reach, is joy. There is radiance and glory in darkness, could we but see. And to see, we have only to look. I beseech you to look. Life is so generous a giver, but we, judging its gifts by their covering, cast them away as ugly or heavy or hard. Remove the covering, and you will find beneath it a living splendour, woven of love by wisdom with power. Welcome it, grasp it, and you touch the angel's hand that brings it to you. Everything we call a trial, a sorrow, or a duty, believe me, that angel's hand is there. The gift is there, and the wonder of an overshadowing presence. Your joys, too, be not content with them as joys. They, too, conceal diviner gifts. Life is so full of meaning and purpose, so full of beauty beneath its covering, that you will find earth but cloaks your heaven. Courage then to claim it, that is all. But courage you have, and the knowledge that we are pilgrims together, wending through unknown country home. And so, at this time, I greet you, not quite as the world sends greetings, but with profound esteem, with the prayer that for you, now and forever, the day breaks and shadows flee away.
Thank you, Richard. A lovely reading, isn't it? I found it in a very old book of poetry I had lying around. Well, look, I know just as well as you do it's not Christmas yet, but Margaret already explained about her long absence. The terrace singers were ready to offer gifts of seasonal choral pieces, so we make a virtue out of a necessity, and we thank them for their presence here today. It may not be Christmas yet, but it's hard to escape, isn't it? We might as well embrace what offered goods there are as we would embrace gifts from a guest who happens to arrive a little bit before the feast starts. Once you trip over the line into December, the holiday frames everything we do this month, and there's a sense of pregnant anticipation and build-up to that one day of the year. As you've seen, the decorations are everywhere and have been for a while, and the shops have begun to flog Christmas wares months ago. December is kind of like the calendar's linchpin. It's the day that holds all time together, as someone said. Another year will be rounded off, and so there'll be much enforced jollity and slap-up spending. So much overt encouragement for celebration, and it's never without its downsides, from the appallingly drunken office parties to the jammed Samaritan's phone lines. Think now, all of you, please, about keeping your pastoral antenna tuned. Psychologists say it's the most stressful time of the year, despite, or perhaps because of, all the expectation and the revelry and the excess. People may need you to reach out to them and tell them it's okay, that this will pass, it's just December. No one does this as perfectly as the cultural messages tell us to do. We all do the best we can in a time when everybody else seems to be doing it the right way, while we inwardly fret that we're somehow missing out or screwing it up if the prawns aren't perfectly cooked, or the gifts aren't dazzlingly well considered, or the heirloom ornaments just can't be located from the attic this year. Humbug to all that, I say. How can we not look away from things like this that may break our hearts? How can we see them clearly? Seeing clearly, it's clear that much of Christmas is a transparent fraud, starting with, I'm sorry, baby Jesus himself. He wasn't born on 25th of December, but in the spring, if he was born at all. And our AD celebrations are timed to overlay the Roman Bacchanals. That's not a shot from Hindley Street. The Bacchanals were a feast of purgation through excess. Fraud, like sleigh bells, is in the air. the most widespread of which is the fiction that Christmas is experienced as monolithically wonderful by all, or more or less the same by everybody, a kind of golden age fantasy where Gran and Gramps are still alive, sentient, and there, and there's turkey and gifts and stuff, and everybody gets along, and it's all lovely. Everybody playing at happy families, despite the fact that step and blended families are increasingly the norm, and despite the fact that plenty of nuclear families are viper pits of toxicity. No wonder there are so many calls to the Samaritans. And the fraud we perpetuate on children, lying to them about Father Christmas for years, until they get to be, oh, about, I don't know, how old were you, 10 or so, and work it out for themselves? I've never been able to reconcile myself to lying to my own children about this. How, we don't even do it that well. I mean, how transparent must the fraud be for a 10-year-old to work it out? I mean, it's not higher math. And that discovery on their part hits them hard. I think you remember it probably hit you hard. It marks that first fall from faith, setting them up for a lifetime of similar delusions based on things not seen, and sundering forever their entire trust in their parents and in authority. I was schooled in committing this fraud and excess myself by my loving parents. My Christmases were more or less typical of working class kids brought up by Depression era parents. Because they were brought up in the Depression, Christmas for us was an absolute orgy of presents for which my parents saved all year round in now defunct Christmas clubs. I don't know if you had them here. Working men saved all year long for this. There are pictures, and I'm going to spare them. Also, I couldn't find them. But there are pictures of piles of stuff of me and my brother are literally swamped and dwarfed by. Piles of stuff. Yet if you look beyond the gifts to the environments of our house, the dining room chairs needed covering, the carpet was threadbare, and our stereo system was home-built by my dad out of plywood and recycled parts he had liberated from work. The prelude to this gratuitous orgy of almost entirely plastic products was that we would wake in the morning to find our stocking on our bed filled by Santa, Father Christmas to you. Typically, there'd be socks in the stocking or something, candy canes, boiled sweets, and deep in the toe of the Christmas stocking would be, bizarrely wrapped in aluminum foil, one of these, an orange. When I find myself getting cynical about Christmas, as I am wont to do, asking where has the sacred in this time, in this tawdry but once considered sacred time gone, when I find myself getting cynical about that, it comes in the unlikely form of this ordinary piece of fruit. This is not to say that we weren't well fed, as Americans of the 50s and 60s could be on masses of junk food, you know, think Twinkies. So this gift of healthy food from Santa ranked rather low in the day's delights. The orange was always overlooked, the orange was hardly ever eaten, and it was sometimes left on our dresser to wither as we got on with stuffing ourselves with holiday treats. Even after I had worked out that there was no Santa, or rather that Santa was my dad, I even asked them not to give the orange to me because it was a waste. Actually, because it took up room in the stocking that could be more usefully filled with other good stuff. But that was my cover story. Such a waste, Dad. He'd always say, I don't know anything about it. It wasn't from me. It's from Santa. Oh, my God. And the sock and the orange and the increasingly tiresome insistence that Santa was responsible for this, not him, not his hard work and frugal savings, this rather fey story continued for decades, even when I was at university. Even when I was sleeping in my old room between apartment leases, there was the sock with the orange in it, insistent and enduring. Even when I moved to the UK and had kids of my own, Santa would always send me something like a chocolate orange channeled through this bizarre supply chain from the North Pole, evidently, through Baltimore to me in London. This, of course, helped me perpetuate this fraud and pass it on like a genetic deformity to my kids. Until they too figured it out, challenged me to admit it, and I did fess up. And Christmases were never the same again. Were never the same after that loss of faith. Out with the faith goes the magic. There's nothing like the eyes of a child on Christmas morning, and nothing like the look in those eyes when they work out that you've been lying to them for years and the magic isn't real. They look in the look in their eyes when they lose faith, when they see there's nothing behind the curtain. Faith, St. Paul tells us, is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Hypostasis is his Greek word for faith. It's like the reality of your house's foundations that you can't see. The evidence for their existence is in the fact that the house is standing. Like a house's foundations. My parents kept faith in perpetuating the unseen magic part of Christmas. Why would loving parents do that? Their insistence on it made me lose a little respect for them, or rather made me feel that they didn't respect me enough to tell me the truth, or even own up to it when the fraud was undeniable. They would never, ever confirm my disillusionment, preferring instead to maintain this fiction. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice. And fool my own kids I did. Though I resolved, as we all do, never to become our parents, I did anyway, despite myself. It was in the wee Christmas morning hours after my girls, exhausted by anticipation, would be asleep. I was often putting together swing sets, climbing frames, trampolines, and such. Like my father before me, I'd get out wrenches and screwdrivers and it'd bloody my knuckles. I can still see my father's Christmas morning hands. Looked like they'd been in a Christmas Eve bar fight. The air at night thick with muffled curses as I, like him, struggled with translated assembly instructions, noises which in my innocence as a child I took to be reindeer and elves going about their business. Looking back on those years of hushed assembly in the wee hours, running out myself to all-night service stations to get batteries that were never included, doing in short a whole lot of crap I didn't want to do especially, that I began to figure out what the ongoing congenital fraud actually meant, why my parents dutifully stuck with it, and why I was dutifully passing it on. It wasn't disrespect. It wasn't magical thinking. It was something better, or rather more substantial, to use St. Paul's term. It was a particular kind of love I had not known before I became a parent. Just so you know, love does come in a wide variety of flavors and colors. Immanuel Kant was one of the first thinkers to clearly distinguish between two kinds of love, pathological and practical. He says, "Love as an affection cannot be commanded, but beneficence for duty's sake may be, even if we are not impelled to it by any inclination, nay, are even repelled by a natural and unconquerable aversion. This is practical love and not pathological, a love which is seated in the will and not in the feelings, in principles of action and not of tender sympathy. It is this love alone which can be commanded." To break that down again for you, pathological love based in the feeling of love, which can't be controlled. Of course, feelings come and go like the weather. It depends on your inclination, and your inclinations are changeable. And you have to feel that love in order to express and give it. Practical love, on the other hand, is based in the will, wanting to do good for others. It can be controlled. It is our duty to be beneficent when we can. It is therefore fixed and not changeable, and you don't have to feel like that love to give it. Anybody who has kids knows that you don't always love them, but you always do loving things for them. So barking my knuckles on bolts and pulling my hair out over garbled assembly instructions at 3 a.m. in the self-same way, I recognize that just like me, my parents didn't particularly want to be putting themselves through this. They would have probably preferred, their inclination might have been, a bottle of wine and an old movie. Just as I knew, as they surely must have, sensed that the money splashed out on toys and such is ultimately wasted and would have been better spent for us on a better house, on our education, on furniture that wasn't collapsing, or not simply racking up credit card debt. I did not then, and don't now, always particularly feel like doing Christmas. Nor did my parents, I suspect. But not feeling like it and doing it anyway, willing it to happen, that's what Kant means by practical love, and where any true moral worth lies because you've chosen it. If you were inclined to do it in the first place, where's the credit in doing what you already feel like doing? Where's the sacrifice in that? It's just doing what you feel like, and anybody can do what they feel like. And those feelings can just as easily go away, like weather. The duty to be loving towards others remains. And in performing this practical love for my kids, I realized that I would never be loved again as I had by parents that had made such sacrifices for love, practical love, unconditional and willed. Had I only known it then that their absurd insistence on Santa, on the spirit of Christmas, this knowing fraud they insisted upon, was a self-effacing way of showing, to themselves at least, that they could do it, they could embody, even if just for a short time, the sacrifice of practical love itself. They say it's the thought that counts, but it's no good just thinking about giving somebody a gift. You need to do the deed as well as the thought, which brings me back to this unwanted orange. It turns out, I did a little research in this, it turns out that the gift of an orange at Christmas is an Anglo-Irish tradition from whom we get many of our Christmas traditions. In the cold climates of the Northern Hemisphere, this fruit was rare and a positive boon to getting through the winter without catching pneumonia. An orange here and there in a Northern Hemisphere winter boosted vitamin C and therefore fortified the immune system against a want of fresh vegetables and sunlight. It was, in short, a kind of gift of life itself, expensive back then as gold, comforting as myrrh, fragrant as frankincense, wise men's gifts. Its origins are, in fact, an act of practical love. When my parents gave me an orange, they did so without thinking about any of that, of course. They passed on the gift, this talisman of life itself, down the generations, not even knowing why they were doing it, but doing it because it was done for them. And so this orange giving exists as a kind of cultural memory, invisible, timeless, and everywhere, like the spirit itself. Such gifts of love are important even if you don't think why you're doing it. It's the act of giving itself, mindful or not, out of duty, out of beneficence, as Kant would say, an act of practical love. You don't have to feel like it. You don't have to even know why you're doing it. But if we can give, we are bound to give. Kant says it is a duty to be beneficent when we can. We can most easily when the time of year makes it an expectation. So out of practical love, I need a little hand with this. I have a gift for all of you. So you're getting an orange in remembrance of all those wasted oranges from my youth, the ones that melted on my dresser or got thrown out surreptitiously, a talisman of health, a talisman of well-being, of life itself, and willed rather than felt love. And now, once you've got your orange, we'll do a little meditation with it. I see any oranges in this church after service today, I'm going to be seriously mad. I'm going to be hopping mad. Just for a start for this meditation, just hold the orange in your two hands like an offering, like that, just like this. Just hold the offering in your two hands. Hold this orange. These are not natural, by the way. These are a product of genetic modification and careful cross-cultivation for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. They originated in China, began as something closer to a kumquat, gradually modified over crossbreeding for years to resemble the thing we have today. It's gone all the way around the world. So, just holding the orange in your two hands, lift it to your nose and smell its goodness. Scratch the peel a little bit to release some of the oil and get that into you. Isn't that nice? Now, looking at it, call to mind the supply chain that brought it to you. Who planted the seed that became the tree? Who watered it and grew it? Who picked it and packed it and crated it and stacked it on the fruiterer's shelves? Perhaps call to mind even that unseen and unseeable intelligence which ordered nature in such a way as to produce life-supporting fruit and the capability in us to cultivate and distribute it all over the globe, not native to Australia. And this may be the last Christmastide I serve as your minister, not knowing whether you even like oranges or might be allergic to them. I would ask you never to forget that this gift, this least of things, this is the least of things you'll get this Christmas. If you look beyond the thing itself, as the reading talks about, this little thing betokens love, not necessarily felt love for you. No one can say we're romantically in love with each other, but love that is practical and willed. Beneficence from duty, and there can be no fraud in such a gift of love. And this Christmas that looms, when we each get a chance to become practical love itself, may the giving we do be mindlessly beneficent. May the receiving we do look past the traditions of the season to what lies beneath all the half-considered gifts, the socks, jocks, and chocks that we get. For all these are mere tokens of an imperfect human shot, an imperfect human shot at how things ought to be, at practical, practiced love. Though we all try to be Santa, maybe Christmas is not fully a fraud after all, just a piece of clunky human theater we've inherited and that we replay, containing, like this fruit, the seeds of the only living thing that can make this existence bearable. And that is love. Amen. Thank you for your generous offerings. There's also a tap point we have brand new that you can just tap your card on the way out if you didn't bring cash today. You want to support this church and its work. It's just out there. Let's join and sing our closing hymn. On our warm Australian Christmas, it's sung to the tune of Once Embroiled, David's City. Please rise as you are able. May we see life as a generous giver. There is nothing we can give to each other which we do not already have. There is much, very much, that we can take and accept. No heaven can come to us unless our hearts find rest in it today. Take heaven. No peace lies in the future which is not hidden in this present little instant. Take peace. The gloom of the world is but a shadow. Behind it, yet within our reach, is joy. There is radiance and glory in darkness, could we but see. And to see, we have only to look. I beseech you to look. Amen. And have a great week.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.